When I was a kid watching Eddie Murphy on Saturday Night Live, I was like, one day I hope to be the racial justice ambassador for the ACLU. From Topic Studios and WarnerMedia Podcast Network, this is Politically Reactive. I'm W. Kamau Bell.
And I'm future Mango Juice spokesperson, Hari Kundabolu. We all have dreams, baby.
Once again, we're two friends and stand-up comics and dads trying to make sense of American politics.
Fortunately, we get some help from people who are on the front lines defending and reinventing our democracy.
And sometimes we get some help from places you wouldn't expect.
People don't think about the fact that when you're on reality TV, you have this big responsibility.
Portia Williams is a big name in reality TV. She's one of the stars of The Real Housewives of Atlanta, a show I've never seen, but I hear it has a fair dose of pettiness and backstabbery.
And a soupçon of tomfoolery.
Is there some tomfoolery in there too?
There's a little tomfoolery. Portia is also the granddaughter of the Reverend Hosea Williams, a civil rights leader and a friend and collaborator of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And in 2020, Portia traveled from her home in Atlanta to Kentucky to demand justice for Breonna Taylor, and she took her Atlanta with her.
I got some gangster. I'm going to go hard for you. And to me, there's really no limit if I feel like what I'm fighting for is right.
We talk about her late-night self-education in politics and American history. We talk about civil disobedience. And, of course, we talk about her grandfather.
A lot of time when I was out there and, you know, facing danger and et cetera, I would think about him. And I knew, and I would try to put myself in his mindset and just be strong and keep moving forward for the purpose.
The purpose is justice. And before we get into our conversation with Portia Williams, we'll hear from the ACLU's Renika Moore about the racial justice agenda of the ACLU as the Biden-Harris administration gets going.
That includes rolling back a lot of Donald Trump's destructive racist bullshit. But also it involves pushing ahead to combat racist policing and housing discrimination.
There's a lot of racist bullshit to push ahead through. And also we're going to talk about... Reparations.
Plus, we'll give you a special opportunity to tell us when we've gotten it wrong. Have we gotten it wrong?
Nah. It's all coming up on Reactive Politically. Oh, shit, I just got it wrong.
Oof. Well, let's keep it in because it makes us look honest. Hey, Kamau.
Hey, Harry.
How you feeling? Inauguration happened. We're in the Biden era, an era I never thought would exist, ever. Neither did he.
No, he definitely didn't. I mean, I don't know if I brought this up last time. At the end of Avengers Endgame, there's this plot line is about how, spoiler alert, Avengers Endgame came out 2 years ago. But there's a plot line where they say that there's only one timeline of all the parallel timelines where they would have success. We're in that Avengers Endgame. Biden is that. There's only one timeline of all the parallel universes where Biden is the president, and we're in that timeline.
Yeah, I mean, when Obama gave him, was it the Medal of Freedom?
Mm-hmm.
Look, that was a retirement gift.
Yes.
In no way did he expect, like, and then Joe will be president, of course. over the next 4 years? No, 4 years after that.
After that, yeah. That was hanging his jersey in the rafters. I hope it goes better, but we're Michael Jordan on the Wizards right now. But I hope it goes better than it did for Jordan.
But the thing is, Biden wasn't Michael Jordan the first time around.
Also true. Also fair. So this is Dennis Rodman on the Dallas Mavericks for
right.
Deep cut sports references. I want to give him credit. There has been a lot of executive actioning. There's been a lot of,
yes,
like, you know, he the Keystone Pipeline is over.
Yep.
He just rescinded Trump's ban of transgender people in the military.
Yep.
There has been, you know, there's been a lot of executive actioning.
Right off the bat, he made it clear we're in another era, which is great. But, you know, one thing that frustrates me, and it was clear during the inauguration, which, by the way, inauguration, Garth Brooks, really? Like, I get J-Lo and, you know, I get J-Lo and Lady Gaga, I get, right? Because that's just like saying, fuck you, Donald Trump. That's just like a rubbing it in to make sure. Like,
That's funny. I never thought of J-Lo that way. Yeah, but J-Lo, because J-Lo's also from New York and it's a Latinx person. Yep.
But it's also just stars. It's like they're both from New York, but it's just like stars. Look at these stars. But who'd you get? Oh, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. For the inauguration. Oh, they were available. I mean, you know, that's not a big. It's like he couldn't get anybody else to agree. They don't even want him, like, people don't even want him to play recorded versions of their songs.
I mean,
like,
let's be clear. He did get Three Doors Down to play his inauguration. That was the big band for the inauguration. Yeah, I think at Trump's inauguration, he had Three Doors Down, who had, I've been told, had a hit song at some point in the 90s. And he had a black woman singer named Chrisette Michelle, who did it as a way to, she wanted to try to unify the way Biden's talking about unifying, but it did not work out for her. And I've read an article about how it basically totally destroyed her career performing at the Trump inauguration. So shout out to Chrisette Michelle, wherever you are.
Garth Brooks? Mm. Who are you trying to piss off with Garth Brooks? Are there people on the right who love Garth Brooks who are like, no, not Biden's inauguration? Like, why Garth Brooks?
Well, see, I think you're underselling as a black man who's married to a white woman who grew up in a small town in America. Garth Brooks is kind of the J-Lo of small town America. Right. She was like, she got a little bit like, I mean, she's not a, she like, he was just one of those things that if you were a small town white person, yeah. Garth Brooks was a part of your life, just in the same way that J-Lo was a part of people's lives growing up. So yeah, Garth Brooks, and he's such a big star that he can take the hit on like pissing off the percentage of his fans who are like, I can't believe you did that. He's like, my accountant says I'm all right.
Well, he also is so big, he took the hit for being Chris Gaines for an album.
No, so many people are like, "That's once he took off the hat, that's not Garth Brooks, that's Chris Gaines."
Right. It's like, I mean, by the way, for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, Google Garth Brooks, Chris Gaines, and see the image of him, the wig. I mean, the whole thing.
It was a very famous person having a midlife crisis publicly. In a way that was like, somebody needs to write the definitive Garth Chris Gaines book, because it's super. I remember they did a whole Behind the Music about the fake character Chris Gaines.
Oh my God. I mean, very few people could get away with it. Like David Bowie kind of could do, because he was doing characters.
He got away
and
with
stuff.
It. He got away with it.
Yeah, I mean, that was part of the thing. Beyonce, wasn't she Sasha Fierce? Beyonce
That's
can do
totally, it. Totally, she did not play Saturday Night Live. Garth Brooks hosted Saturday Night Live. And Chris Gaines was the musical guest.
Jesus Christ.
That's their David Bowie, Beyonce. It didn't get to that level of you actually. They did not cast actors to play the younger version of their fake character.
Oh, jeez. And then, you know, everyone's talking about, oh, Biden's speech was so good. Chris Wallace said it was the greatest inauguration speech you ever heard, which is ridiculous. It was okay. He did the thing he was supposed to do. He's not Obama. He's not Kennedy. But, he's not Chris, this incredible orator.
Chris,
you know?
Wallace was also trying to piss off Trump. That was definitely like
that was right. It was so good how we kept using the word unity over and over again.
How he never referenced American carnage.
Also, it's ironic Trump talked about American carnage in his, I was going to say in his act, which it kind of was, his inaugural address. And then 400,000 people died because
he created American carnage. He told us it was coming, and boy, did it ever come.
I think what bugs me is, like, so he's talking about unity, and everyone's talking about unity. Republicans, Democrats have to unify. We need unity in this country. And it's such bullshit. It's not unity that you're not going to get. Where was unity after Sandy Hook? Do you know what I mean? Where was it not just like thoughts and prayers unity, but actual action? So, you know, these children who were murdered because of gun violence and the wrong person having a gun actually got justice. Where was the unity then? Where was the unity now that we're all like in the middle of this COVID era for states to be like, okay, we need a strong federal response, because if you do it state by state, it's not going to work. Because you know what? A virus doesn't give a shit about state borders. Doesn't give a shit. All right, that's not how this works. Where was the unity then? What is this unity talk? I don't need unity with the right. What I need is civility. I need a functioning government. I need them to stop obstructing, to stop filibustering, which is like this terrible relic that was useful during like the slavery era and the civil rights era for, you know, right wingers to stop. And yeah, I know they were Democrats. Fuck it, that's not the point. Like, there was fascist, all right? It was racist.
Yes.
You know, a way to stop him. That, fuck unity. Unity is weak. We don't need unity. What we need is fairness. We need efficiency. Mm. We need people to actually do their fucking jobs. That's what we need.
Yes. The theme of his speech was apparently America United. I was like, I preferred America Untied. Like, I feel like we have to untie ourselves from the parts of this country that are actually trying to pull us all down. And I don't think, I don't want to unify with them. I don't want to be unclear with that. I don't want them to think I want to unify with them. As I've heard from the Republicans, elections have consequences. So this one should also have consequences. The thing I feel with Joe Biden doing that I didn't feel with Obama, I feel like he is driving it like he stole it a little bit. He is signing a bunch of executive actions. They're doing a weird thing called press conferences every day. I don't know if you've heard of that. The first time there was a press conference 2 days in a row, I was like, wait a minute, what are they trying to not hide? I got confused.
Wait a second, is this exercising the rights of a free and open press? What?
Is this engaging with the First Amendment openly and on? Yeah.
What is this, the 1800s? When did we last do this?
So there are so many problems that Trump left us. As they said, apparently there was no sort of COVID plan that was left behind, so that they have to really start all over. Dr. Deborah Birx, who was one of the doctors who was in, who was part of Trump's COVID response team.
Who was held hostage by Donald Trump.
Well, yes, but, and also, you know, the difference between Dr. Birx and Dr. Fauci is Dr. Fauci, you could tell on his face when he was like, this motherfucker doesn't know what he's talking about.
Right.
Or this is making me crazy that he's saying this. And he would go do interviews on like The Daily Show or with Steph Curry and say the things he wanted to say at the press conference. You know, he was very clear about which side he was on. Deborah Birx, not so much. So now she did an interview with CBS on Face the Nation, where basically it was the equivalent of somebody saying, here's my dirty laundry, can you clean this for me?
Like, instead of saying something during the time or like trying to make a remark, it's like after the fact.
Now that I'm out, here's the things I would have said. She had a whole thing where she said that many times she would give them charts and graphs, and then somebody would change them, and then she would see them up on when she was standing on the dais and he would be referring to them and they had been changed. What kind of medical professional are you that you don't just go, hey, stop, this is wrong? You know, that you just sort of sit there and go, huh, somebody changed that and now it's all wrong. Anyway, I'm just gonna stand here. Did you notice my nice scarf? It's pretty nice.
I've never been held hostage in such a way, but I would imagine that you make choices in that situation that maybe is telling of who you are at your core, but it's also like doing the best you can in a situation no one expected to be in. How much damage can this man cause? A great deal. Is it better for me to be there than not be there? And if I say something, if I piss him off, is he going to replace me with a fucking radiologist he met? Whatever. I don't even know what happened to that guy, but just some radiologist who's telling nobody needs masks.
It's the same argument we had with Dr. Peter Hotez, who was talking about Dr. Jerome Adams, who the Biden administration wasted no time in telling the Surgeon General, you're done here. You don't need to hang out for a while we get it together. Dr. Vivek Murthy's right here. You can clear out your everything, and we're going to steam clean this area. I get that they're in a difficult position, but at some point, you know, there's a thing called the right side of history and the wrong side of history. And I feel like, and Fauci never quit the Trump administration. He never quit the Trump administration. He always showed up when he was invited. They stopped inviting him because he wouldn't not tell the truth when people asked him questions. Whereas people like Dr. Birx and to some extent Dr. Jerome Adams, they tried to walk this tightrope, and you cannot do that with fascists. I think if history has taught us anything, you can't walk a tightrope with fascists.
Especially, I mean, as a doctor, if not causing harm is something you say, basically, that's your oath, right? Isn't that part of the oath?
Do no harm.
By allowing him to run roughshod on some of these things and using fake graphs and giving false information, isn't that causing harm?
Yeah, the thing I will say is that this is where Kamau becomes the annoying racism guy. You've been that guy before, right, Hari? The guy who brings race into everything, or brings in another thing to this.
That's why we're friends, yes.
Yeah. So that's the basis of our friendship, is two guys who are annoyingly bringing in race to discussions where people don't see them. And also going to bring in sexism. If I have any sort of level of like empathy, it's that Dr. Fauci, white man, Dr. Birx, white woman, Jerome Adams, black man, that there is just a different calculus that you have to sort of do when you're in these, when you're in a position that Dr. Fauci maybe doesn't have to think about because he's a white man. He's like, I'm going to be all right. You know what I mean? So I will get, that is a part of this, but I think if there's a time where you have to stand up, again, it comes about like the right side of history, wrong side of history. And the idea that, like Forbes said, if you are a company and you hire somebody who worked for Trump, we are going to judge your company as not being truthful when you tell us things.
Wow.
So if you hire one of these people who worked for the Trump administration and you tell us that you have this new product and it does A, B, C, and D, we're just going to assume you're lying.
I love that. Because this whole thing is branding, and now the Trump brand is so worthless.
Yeah, so I think that's the part about this Dr. Birx thing. She's now saying, hey, everybody, will you help me clean my laundry for me? No, I don't have time to do that.
That's the thing about working under the Trump administration. If you joined late, you knew what you're getting into.
Yes.
Yeah. If you were there and you stayed the whole time, you didn't jump ship early, it's clear that like you're writing this thing out. Yeah. Like there's no way around. And you're right. It's how can you get work after that? Like, how can you? Oh, I did a Homeland Security under Nero. You know, what can you say? Like, you're kind of. I was Julius Caesar's bodyguard. Like,
so you want to work as a farmer? And what was your last job? Oh, overseer. Okay.
Well, that guy has a police job coming. So that's
true. The overseers did not go into farming. That's true. They went to the police academy. There have to be consequences, or else we are doomed to repeat ourselves, and not repeat ourselves in a way like, man, it's weird we got back here. Repeat ourselves in that we become, it's going to be worse. We're going to be a much worse off country, and things are going to get worse and worse.
If I see fucking Kaylee, was it McEnany? If I see fucking Kaylee McEnany on Dancing with the Stars, I'm going to fucking lose my mind.
And you're going to see her. You're 100,000% going to see her.
This fucking country.
She's going to be on, there's going to be a whole bunch of people who end up on Masked Singer. There's going to be a whole... The next season of Masked Singer is only going to be ex-Trump people.
Like, what is that? Eichmann's on the new Celebrity Apprentice. Goebbels? Goebbels is going to take over the Trump position?
This week we're talking to Portia Williams, one of the stars of The Real Housewives of Atlanta, who in 2020 threw herself into working and protesting to demand justice for Breonna Taylor.
But first, we're going to check in with the ACLU's Renika Moore about the racial justice agenda as the Biden-Harris administration gets underway.
Well, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for doing it.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, we're excited to talk about some racial justice.
It seems like we should start with the Trump administration's parting shot that they unveiled on Martin Luther King Jr.'s day, the 1776 Commission.
Oh, no.
What are your thoughts on that? Epic fail.
I started reading it, and just the opening story of the United States just completely obliterates the fact that there were people here when they arrived. And so, you know, the opening document talks about, you know, this was founded with people who came with a dream, and without acknowledging that there were people here living. So from the very beginning, it's obviously a revisionist document that doesn't acknowledge, you know, that there were tribes and indigenous communities here that were pushed out, that were displaced and killed, and doesn't really acknowledge the slavery. Sort of takes the approach of recognizing slavery as like other people were doing it, and you know, it wasn't just us. That's just really troubling, but completely consistent with what the Trump administration had done and the way that it treated communities of color through its tenure. So that would be the parting shot was both not surprising and like just the last, like, are you kidding me? You know, one of the first acts the Biden-Harris administration did was pull the document down. And I think that was absolutely the right move. And the Trump administration, even before that, had adopted an executive order that stopped the ability to really have conversations about this country's legacy of racism and banned all race and gender equity trainings with federal contractors and with federal agencies. And so we had come out and opposed that and had asked that that be one of the first acts of the Biden-Harris administration, which they did. They repealed that because we need to be able to talk about and reconcile with this country's history, its founding, original sin, if we're going to get to a place where everyone can succeed and we can really address these problems head on.
It feels like, I mean, just because they based some of this on the 1619 project, it was a response to it, I should say. And so their response to that was this, which they released on Martin Luther King Day, which is either completely tone deaf or they really double down in the racism.
They absolutely, you know, considered that. I think, you know, what we saw last year, there was on June 19th, Trump was originally planning a rally in Tulsa, which we know was the history of one of the worst attacks on Black community in the 20th century, and that they were planning to have a rally on that day. I think Trump, you know, was prevailed upon to move it to the 20th.
yeah, move it way away from
right.
Like, the master of Black Wall Street.
Exactly.
Move it to the next day. Then Black people will be like, okay, now you can do your racist rally. Cool.
Yeah, exactly. So I think this is completely consistent with what we saw from that administration.
I just also want to make sure that we mention Nicole Hannah-Jones, who's the 1619 Project, because, man, she she made lots of white men angry on all sides of the aisle with that. It's quite an accomplishment to get to get Stephen Miller to write a term paper against the thing you did, because that was clearly Stephen Miller's work, and it even felt like he turned it in at the very last minute.
Right, they were getting it in under the wire.
You know, America is built on white supremacy and racism, but Trump certainly turned up the heat on that. What is Trump's racial justice legacy? I laugh because that's
right.
Ridiculous.
That just feels wrong. All those
feels
words
wrong
together.
Even, yeah.
You know, I think we are particularly concerned about. I'll talk about housing and about policing. I think in the housing space, he repealed some of the key protections against housing discrimination. The Obama administration had adopted a number of rules to really get at not just like explicit discrimination that happens in the housing space, but really like the kinds of rules that, on their face, don't necessarily look like they are discriminatory, but really do have the effect of excluding Black and Brown folks from access to housing and access to certain communities. There were two rules. There was affirmatively furthering fair housing rule that was repealed, as well as the disparate impact rule, which the Trump administration essentially gutted. I mean, they took out the key provisions and made it much harder for folks to be able to challenge the policies that have a disparate impact or affect Black and Brown communities more harshly for no justifiable reason. And so we've been litigating at the ACLU challenging these policies called crime-free housing ordinances that, despite the name, really do just exclude people based on contact with the criminal legal system and contact with police. And because we know that Black and Brown communities are over-policed, even where there are the rates of violations are the same as white communities, we see that in marijuana usage, we see that in other spaces. These kinds of ordinances have been used to exclude Black and Brown folks and even impact people who might be domestic violence survivors if they've called the police to their house or if the police have been called.
Oh, God.
You know, we've got a case in Minnesota about 50 miles from Minneapolis, where George Floyd was killed, where the ordinance is really used to block out Black tenants. And they adopted it as the population in the town was rising of Black and Somali refugees. So it was clearly in response to, there were too many Black people moving in. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly there were concerns about crime. And the minutes of the meetings, of the city council meetings, show that there wasn't actually a spike in crime. And so this kind of ordinance is exactly the kind of discrimination, you know, on its face, it's like, oh, we're concerned about crime. But in fact, this is really about excluding from housing members of the community who you don't want there because of their race. So these are the kind of rules that we need the federal government to have. We need to be able to root out these kind of problems.
It's so America that a spike in Black faces leads white folks to think there's a spike in crime. That if you see more Black faces, you just feel like there's more crime happening. That you know, that you don't need any evidence. Just, I see Black people, there must be crime happening.
Which leads us to police. There are several things that we're asking for from the Biden-Harris administration, including to do away with qualified immunity, which really protects officers when they violate the rights of particularly Black and Brown community members, and being able to hold them accountable. And far too often where someone is killed or hurt, they or their families are not able to hold accountable police officers when they are treated violently and brutally. The history of policing in this country is also can be traced back to slavery, can be traced back to Charleston, where they were used to catch slaves. So we know that that legacy runs long, and there's a through line of racism and brutality in policing as we know it. And so we want to see policies that really seek to divest resources and authority from police departments and reinvest those communities in communities that have been over-policed. We want to see clarity around the rules of when force can be used by police, and the federal government has the ability to establish those. We want to be able to see police to stop using facial recognition technology, because we know about the biases that exist there in that technology. And there have been a fair amount of writing about, you know, the inability, for instance, of these technologies to identify the faces of Black women. So we'd like to see, we're calling on the administration to stop police use of facial recognition technology.
Is the technology basically a way to justify racial profiling? Well, we have science behind it now.
It is. It's really trying to mask what humans used to do, is to say, well, no, these are machines. But in fact, the machines are trained using the information that humans have given to it. So we don't want the technology to hide the discrimination and the bias. And the last piece is, we really want police out of schools. We know that Black and Brown students are over-policed even in school. Schools do not have and need, right, counselors, they need nurses, they need social workers, and they needed that before COVID, and they will absolutely need that as they deal with the trauma of, you know, a friend of mine is a special ed teacher, and so many of her students have lost family. She teaches mostly Black and Latinx students here in New York. And so what we need is resources to really support students. 1.7 million students are in schools that have cops, but not counselors. They don't have the supports that they need. And so what we want to see is the investment in education. There is a bill being pushed called Cops Not Counselors to really address this problem.
Is this a politer and more lawyerly way to say defund the police? Like, we would like counselors and not cops. And maybe we'll take some of that cop money and put it over here with that counselor money.
But, you know, we're following the lead too. We're working with folks on the ground. And this is, you know, this is coming not just from us, but this is really about students and what students are calling for, what their families are like. This is what we need. Like, we don't need police in schools. And that is the reaction frequently to violence that's not perpetrated by Black and Brown students, right?
The Biden-Harris administration, you know, it's been less than a week at this point. Yes. What have they done so far to not only reverse what Donald Trump has done, which is certainly part of it, but actually push forward? Also, what else are they going to be pushing forward in the coming weeks and months? Hopefully. Right.
Sure. Well, they released a slate of executive orders on day one that were around pulling back some of the discriminatory actions of different agencies. So around immigration, ensuring stopping, you know, construction and money being spent on the border wall. They are trying to halt some of the immigration removal proceedings. The race and gender equity ban was lifted over the past couple of years. Folks have really, we've really been highlighting that these are about systemic issues, and we're thinking about, what does systemic equality look like? Like, what would that look like? And what are the systems we need to see? And I think some of the initial actions that have been taken are beginning to address that. You know, some of the things, so I've talked about some of the executive orders, and some of these pieces are going to take longer. A good sign that we've seen is who has been nominated for positions. So in the Department of Justice, we've seen Kristen Clark was nominated for head of the Civil Rights Division, and Vanita Gupta is not nominated for the number three in DOJ. And these are folks who Vanita is a ACLU alum. Kristen and I have worked together. And these are people, if you're serious about civil rights, this is who you hire.
One thing we have to talk about that the ACLU is very big on right now. Hurry, I'm going to need you to step out of this conversation for a moment. Reparations.
Yeah.
Why does he have to step out? He should join.
No, I just... I Indians tend to be white collaborators. I understand. I got it.
No, just kidding. Because I think reparations is a big, huge idea. It is an idea that even people who think it's a good idea don't know that we should talk about, because you're going to get white folks mad, you know. Mm. So why is that something that the ACU feels is so important in highlighting and really putting forward, and not sort of like putting as like somewhere down the line?
We see economic justice and really tackling not just the last presentation of the issue and the downstream, like this is how it is showing itself today, but really going back, digging in and getting at the roots of these problems in order to ensure that we've got lasting equity, we've got lasting equality, and we've got an ability to really bring folks along. And so HR 40 is really about that, and about recognizing the history of our country and really looking hard at it. Mm-hmm. HR 40, which is sponsored by Sheila Jackson Lee, and has, at this point, it actually has over 100 co-sponsors. And so there is real momentum and support within the House to really look at this. In the HR 40 would establish a commission of experts, including economists and historians from various fields, to really look at the legacy of slavery and its impact on modern society and disparities within modern society, and make proposals about how we address those issues. This country hasn't done that. There hasn't been that reckoning, and there hasn't mm-hmm. been that like we're gonna really dig in here, and we're gonna understand like what role the federal government played. Like, we know about redlining, or maybe folks don't, but the federal government was instrumental in creating some of the disparities in housing we see by refusing to insure houses in communities that were predominantly Black. They encouraged restrictive covenants that prevented people from buying houses in predominantly white areas. And before that, we know that folks were not allowed to maintain loans. We talked about the riots on Black Wall Street and failures to really protect Black communities. We know that, for example, the Fair Labor Standards Act, which establishes the minimum wage, when it was adopted, there was an agreement with Southern senators to exclude domestic workers and agricultural workers, because these were the former slaves who had worked the fields, who had worked within the house, and they did not want to be included in these white Southerners didn't want to pay them and treat them as employees and pay them for their work. So it's not just slavery, it's like what happened after slavery and what happened after that we're talking about and thinking about. And we really have to dig in and look at what that history breeds us. And there's been some, you know, we talked about Nicole Hannah Jones, Ta-Nehisi Coates. Like, we've seen the work that journalists have done, but we really need an established congressional committee to really look into this and to be able to make some serious recommendations about how we move forward, which we're not going to be able to do until we've done that work.
My last question is, and Hari, you can come in back in if you'd like to.
Okay. I got my headphones
on. But I hope you were listening, because this is like, yeah, he's listening.
I went to your Twitter, like I like to see people's Twitter. The last mm-hmm. day you tweeted was January 6th. I was like, was it like after the insurrection, you're like, I'm done.
I'm done.
How many drafts for rage tweets are in your folder right now that you had to...
No, it's a real thing. It's a real thing. It's funny. My little sister is 26 and a much more savvy social media user. She's often clowning me about it. She's like, what is it you're doing? Like, you're trying. So I think, you know, that was definitely like, it's been a rough 4 years, right? Yeah. And so you're like, no, this is, we made it to inauguration. We have you know, we can fight some new fights, yeah. I think is really exciting. And so I think you see the Twitter feed. Now, I will say that I do provide tweets for our ACLU account.
Those are not usually, I mean, there's some rage in there, but that's usually very it's exactly. calculated. It's not exactly. like, it's not what are these MFers, none of that. So,
And then I feel like we also watched, with our 15-year-old, we watched like one of the Netflix social media like documentaries around that.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, so I was like, okay, I can take a break. I'm a mental health check.
It was really good to have you on, and from what I was allowed to listen to our conversation, you were really great. Like, it was really...
Yeah, thanks for doing this.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It was really great to talk to you both.
Renika Moore is the director of the ACLU's Racial Justice Program.
The ACLU has a petition to divest from police and invest in Black and brown communities. You can find the link in the show notes for this episode and on Twitter and Instagram. You can also go to aclu.org.
And while you're at aclu.org, the ACLU has made it super easy for you to send a message to Congress telling them we need reparations for slavery now. Go to ACLU.org and you can fill out that message and get it to your congressperson.
Kamau, do you know what I enjoy?
Let's see, the New York Mets, weirdly, 90s basketball, not hearing about Charles Smith getting blocked by several Chicago Bulls players.
Okay, yeah, those are some of the things. But I also love telling people they're wrong. That's really true. Nothing like it. I mean, I've based part of my career on that alone.
You just write the jokes so you can have funny ways to tell people they're wrong.
Correct.
Well, now, if you're listening to the show, you get to join the fun, too. We've got a special episode coming up called My Bad, where we, me and Hari, will respond to listeners who have called us on the carpet for things we've gotten wrong in this season of Politically Reactive.
I do know we've heard from some listeners who are deeply unhappy about how we talked about asexuality, as well as how we talked about Puerto Rican statehood. For the latter, I might live with that person and potentially have made a child with them. That'll be covered.
Leave us a voicemail at 917-477-6525. That's 917-477-6525. Leave us a message, tell us what we got wrong, and we will deal with it.
Also, please keep the obscenity to a minimal. We do have feelings.
We can't tone police our corrections.
Please, please. No,
just say what you're going to say. Because like, if the obscenity is really good, Hari, we're going to use it. Let's be clear
fine,
about that.
Fine.
Portia Williams is one of the stars of The Real Housewives of Atlanta and a co-host of Dish Nation.
She's also the granddaughter of the Reverend Hosea Williams, civil rights leader and close associate of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And this past summer, she followed in his footsteps, committing civil disobedience and demanding justice for Breonna Taylor.
Yeah, and I got to meet Portia in, let's say, June of 2020. We were both on Watch What Happens Live on Bravo, which is not a show I get invited on very often. But they invited me on to talk about America in the wake of the murder of George Floyd. And Portia was booked on the show, and I thought she was just booked on because she is on The Real Housewives of Atlanta, but she's even more real than that. She talked a lot about her grandfather and his effect on her, and she talked about what she wanted to do and what Bravo needed to do. And over the course of the last few months, I've seen her not only hold Bravo to the fire to be better within its relationship to the Black community, she's also included a lot of that stuff in the show. And I've also followed her on Instagram and seen different wig lines and sheets I should buy for my bed. So she is a fully rendered three-dimensional person. She's amazing. Didn't expect to have this person in my life, but she's here and I'm excited to share this conversation with her with you all.
Honestly, it was a fantastic conversation, so let's get right to Portia. Here we go.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for doing this. We appreciate it.
Absolutely.
I mean, I feel like we've met because we did Andy Cohen's show, and that was quite a deep dive on that show.
For a first time meeting, yes, it was.
I think I got booked to do that show before George Floyd was murdered. And when I got booked it, I was like, okay, this is a little bit outside of my lane. Bravo. I'm not going to act like I don't watch Bravo.
Right.
I'm not going to act like that. But I definitely was like not someplace where I normally do gigs. And then
right.
George Floyd was murdered. And I was like, oh, I'm still doing this? And I sort of went into this like not knowing what was going to happen. You were booked on the show. I was familiar with you, but didn't know nearly enough about you.
Mm-hmm.
And then we sat down there. And after a while, I was like, wait, why'd they book me? I think she can take it from here.
Oh, stop it. No, same thing for me. You know, his show is normally lighthearted. Most of the things on Bravo are. But I think that they were tapped in to the pulse of the people. And that is not what they wanted to see right then. They wanted to hear, you know, someone who can articulate what we all were going through. And, you know, I remember from that conversation when you talked about your daughter and how she was taking it in as a child. And that was a big thing to me, like to hear how older kids were taking it. Because, you know, sometimes as parents, you just kind of go along with what's happening, try to protect them from what, you know, the evil world around them. But the fact that she was digesting it and she wanted to stand up and say how proud she was to be Black, but also cared about her mother's feelings. Like, that was such a great conversation that we had that day. So at the end of the day, of course, I was excited to meet you anyway, but I was glad that I was able to do it.
Since I've been following you on Instagram since then, and it's been very clear to me that you are very comfortable showing your life and showing what you want and your entrepreneurship. And so you can get a photo from you where it's like, look at me all glammed up, ready to go out and do the town. And also look at me getting arrested as I do activism around Breonna Taylor. Can you talk about what it's like to be in the world and showing all of that?
Showing my life on social media, it's also part of my brand, which is something that has formed over the years that I've been being blessed to have. They gave me this platform. But when it came to Breonna Taylor, that was me trying to figure out how to leverage this brand, this platform for that case and for Breonna's case. And, you know, honestly, it just felt like a duty. It just felt like something that I was supposed to do. And I think it was easier for me to tap into that side of activism and sacrifice. And you know how we are in this entertainment industry, not really give a damn what nobody had to say, because my family's legacy, my grandfather, that's what he did. So it was right there. And I just got the tap on the shoulder that it was time for me to activate it.
Can you talk a little bit about your grandfather?
Yeah, so my grandfather is Reverend Hosea Williams, civil rights activist, philanthropist, and he worked a lot with Martin Luther King. That he was the person who organized the marches. He was the person who would get everybody and rally them together and get them fired up about the cause and help them understand what the purpose is, what the demands are, what you're there to do. Because what a lot of people don't really understand is back then and how I have operated and protesting now with Until Freedom, there's a way to do everything. It's really taught. It's very, very organized. It's not just people out there, you know, rah-rah. They're out there very focused. And so he was one of those foot soldiers who would get their demand, find out what they were doing, and get everybody organized and ready to go. And he was also on the bridge, Edmund Pettus Bridge, for Bloody Sunday. And, you know, all the people, I'm just bringing up things people remember.
Hold up. Wait a minute.
Let's take a moment to remember a few more things about the Honorable Reverend Hosea Williams. In World War II, he served the United States Army in an all-African-American Army unit under General George Patton. Heard of him? He was the only survivor of a Nazi bombing, which earned Hosea Williams a Purple Heart. When he got back to Georgia, he was beaten up by a group of angry white folks at a bus station for drinking water from a water fountain marked Whites Only. The attackers thought he was dead and called a black funeral home in the area to pick up the body.
The hearse driver noticed Williams had a faint pulse and was still alive. No hospital in the area would serve black people, so he was taken to a VA hospital more than 100 miles away. After the war, he earned a high school diploma at the age of 23, and then he earned a bachelor's and master's degree in chemistry. He then worked as a research scientist for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He became a leader in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference along with Martin Luther King Jr. and many others. He played an important role in the demonstration in St. Augustine, Florida that helped spur the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
And as Portia mentioned, along with many other black folks, he was tear gassed and beaten severely on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama on March 7, 1965, the day that will become known as Bloody Sunday. After leaving the SCLC, Williams played an active role in supporting strikes in the Atlanta, Georgia area by black workers who had been hired because of the Civil Rights Act. He ran for governor of Georgia in 1966 and the U.S. Senate in 1972. He was elected to the Georgia State Senate and the Atlanta City Council.
In January of 1987, Williams led a march against fear and intimidation in Forsyth County, Georgia, which at the time had no non-white residents. 90 marchers were assaulted with stones and other objects by several hundred counter-demonstrators led by the Nationalist Movement and Ku Klux Klan. The following week, 20,000 people marched. And in the years following, Forsyth County began to slowly integrate.
He passed away in the year 2000, but I'm sure he's proud of the work that Portia's doing.
For me, he was my grandpa. I called him Babu. And he was very fun, loving, and just everything to me and my family. But one thing that was very important for him to for us to always have is to be connected with the community and just really have a love for people. And so I've always had that, and it's from what he put into us.
Have you been involved in a political cause the way you are with Breonna Taylor? Or was this the first time you're like, I'm going all in on this? And why this particular story, this case?
I feel in the past, I have definitely, you know, done postings, et cetera. But as far as like being physically active where I, you know, hopped on a plane and went there, it was this case for Breonna Taylor because I felt helpless as a mother, as a Black woman, you know, raising a little girl. And I just feeling helpless after seeing George Floyd, after seeing a lot of the things that were happening, waking up out of this bubble of the being quarantined, it was like, I just can't take it. I just could not take it. And when I got to know Breonna through her, just everything that Tamika Mallory had put out there about her, everything that Until Freedom was bringing to light about her case, I was heartbroken. Like, I mourned this beautiful girl like I knew her because she was that type of person that it was like someone in your family. And so I felt like the time was right. I felt like I had the access, the resources to be effective. And so I knew that it was my time to step up and do what I know my grandfather would have done with less than what I have now.
When you're like at rallies, do people do double takes? Like that couldn't be. Is that poor?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, we have on masks, so we do have on masks, but people do that. And when they see me, they just get even more fired up, like, hell yeah, you know, she's out here with us. That's what's up. And I love it. You know, it's not like I'm like trying to hide at the rally. It's like, no, I want my people to know, everyone to know, I'm here to support you. I am here to amplify your voices. Honestly, you know, it's so sad that we even have had to protest and all of that. But when you are out there, there's no other feeling of togetherness that I've ever felt. People of all different races are out there, and we are really crying out for Black lives and even further, just humanity. Just, I think that is like the biggest thing, is that we're just out there as humans. A lot of people think about protests and think it's just a whole gang of Black people. It's all races out there that notice that this is what's being done wrong to this particular race at this particular time.
I mean, it's one thing to, like you said, to post on Instagram. I mean, and you know, a lot of people do that, and you can do that effectively and be a part of the struggle. But it's another thing to actually go to Kentucky. Like, what was it about that? And especially, I don't know if you remember, but last year we were in a global pandemic, still in it. But you know, like, but yeah, at a time where, as a Black person, this pandemic's looking for us. What pulled you to Kentucky?
You know, one thing about being in the pandemic, you know, I know for a fact now, it has touched so close to home to so many people where you know someone who has it, someone has passed from it, et cetera. I've suffered from loss in my family from it. But at that time, in the very beginning, it almost seemed like an invisible attack on us. You couldn't really see it. You just kind of trust in what you see on television. And with that, it's like, okay, fine. They said stay home. I'm going to stay home. So it was kind of like that. It wasn't really connected to me at that moment. Now, when it came to actually opening my phone and having to sit through seeing a Black man being killed, crying out for his mother, God rest his soul, everything he went through while being murdered by those cops. Now that was real. Now that is an enemy that I can see. Hearing about Breonna Taylor and knowing that these cops are there, they're still at work, okay? And the Attorney General isn't doing anything about it, and he actually has the power. We can't tell God, like, God, please, right now, stop this pandemic, okay? Just wipe it out right this second. That won't necessarily happen, okay? But yes, you, Daniel Cameron, you can pick up the phone and you can get these cops arrested. You can do the right thing. You can just do your job. You can just do your job. And I know, and I felt like, guess what? We're just not loud enough. And so I wanted to join the people who were making the noise to be loud enough to force something to happen.
I mean, you got arrested, you know, at the rallies. When you got arrested, was the plan, or were you prepared to get arrested when you went down there? Or was it like, if it happens, I'm ready for it? Or was it a complete shock?
So I've been asked this question a couple of times, but I think the best way to put it is people don't know me like that. Mm-hmm. So people know me on, you know, a reality. Some people have me in this reality show bubble. Some people have me in this television talk show host bubble. But I got some gangster. You know what I'm saying? Like I go for mine. You know, when it comes to my family, when it comes to what's right and wrong, in any little case in my life with any person around me, it could be somebody I just met, I'm going to go to bat for you. I'm going to go hard for you. And to me, there's really no limit if I feel like what I'm fighting for is right. So that's the small piece that people don't really get when they're like, wait, how did you just get up? Because it was wrong. And I'm going to stand up and say it's wrong. And I don't care what I have to lose. I know that this is right and I'm standing on it. Part of it is because I'm very spiritual. And, you know, for me, I felt like this is a spiritual warfare. And I needed to get out there and come outside of who I am, what I have, what people think, whatever. I don't care. And I needed to lean on what God wants us to do, what God say was right. And he wouldn't want us to be down here getting treated like that. And I just felt like he was strengthening me. And so it really was spiritual for me just to say, you know what? I don't care about anything else. I'm going to get up and go fight for this beautiful, young, precious soul that was snatched out of here before this becomes a sport for hunting people who are at home. I'm going to be a part of some change or moving it forward in some type of way.
So I would imagine, you know, this is not behavior that every member of the Real Housewives cast engages in. And you all get negative feedback just for living, just for plot lines
just
on the show.
Changing a wig. Okay. Yes. Now, oh God.
How has the response been from the fans of the show? I would imagine a lot of them are watching your show to get away from thinking about the problems of the day. And then to have you in here agitating, as they say, how right. have fans responded?
That's where, again, you have to believe in people and believe that people do see right from wrong and believe in people's hearts and believe that people want to see something different. I just felt like, you know, it wasn't initially an easy choice just to say, okay, Bravo, here's this footage, you know, because you don't want anything to be mishandled. You don't want to seem any kind of way, right? But then I also, again, felt that sense of responsibility to represent the times, to represent what we were going through. Again, I had to go back to, well, I'm using my platform over here. This is also another launching pad to elevate our message. And so that's when I finally made the decision to go ahead and give it to them. But I was like a mama. I was like, listen, you know, we got to take care of this. This is fragile and this is the messaging, and they have done a great job so far. Basically opening up the Black experience, you know, and I think that we would have been terribly remiss for us just to have a whole nother season and not even show anything about Black Lives Matter. That just would have just been very, very wrong. And I know for a fact the fans would not have liked that. You know, you still have some fans who are like, I want to see some drama or whatever. But no, trust me, the majority was like, no, what are y'all doing about it?
And you're out there with, you've mentioned Until Freedom. Linda Sarsour has been on the podcast before, Tamika Mallory. So you're out there with some real bona fide, hardcore women of color activists. Can you talk about what it is to be with them and how sometimes activists like that, and I don't know them specifically, don't trust us showbiz folks for sort of parachuting in there. But can you talk about how that relationship's going?
You know, I have the utmost respect for both of them. And when you talk to Tamika Mallory, she doesn't even speak like who she is. She is our leader. Like, to me, she's our modern day leader. Like, if she says we're going to the moon, I'm going. Like, whatever she says, I'm going. And I'm trusting her because of her works, but just her spirit and who she is. You know a leader when you're around them. You know someone who has been God-given the vision. She has the vision. They have the vision collectively. And so I trusted them immediately. And you're right. They are heavy hitters, okay? And I was very much new to civil disobedience, and she helped educate me on that. And then I read about when Martin Luther King participated in the civil disobedience, and he had the clergy who were talking about him. Why would you do this? Why would you put yourself in a position, get arrested, et cetera? And I read about his explanation and how he felt about it and how he thought about the whole process of it and why it was important for him to do it the way he did it. And once I educated myself on it, I just sacrificed myself and submitted myself to the process for the bigger cause. Now, when you talk about being with heavy hitters, again, these are people who, they're not gonna blink an eye, okay? These cops mean nothing to them. There was a moment when we were actually right in front of Daniel Cameron's house, and we were marching right in front, and they had not told us yet that we were going to sit on his lawn yet. But now we were in the intersection. And here I look across the street, and there are, I don't know how many police, hundreds of them, who had basically looked like they were in the military, okay? Mm. They were dressed in all black, SWAT gear, big guns and batons, etc. So it looked like war, honestly, is what it looked like. And then on this side, you have people who are completely, who have no weapons, except nothing, but Until Freedom t-shirts on, okay, and sweat. And so I was kind of like around towards the middle, and they were saying, Portia, come to the front. Portia, come to the front. And I'm there, you know, I'm like, yes. And but at that moment, I had to make a choice of like, what you gonna do, you know? What you gonna do? And I was like,
are they talking about Portia de Rossi?
I waited for my last, let's just say I waited for my last name to be called. Was like, Portia Williams. And I was like, okay, fine. And so I went up to the front and I sat down, and I was a soldier for the movement, and it was fine. The only thing I really was the most afraid of is if one of those rubber bullet would have knocked my eye out. Now that is what, but I was ready to take a beating or anything else. That didn't bother me whatsoever. It had no fear of that whatsoever. And I got sat right in front of someone with a rubber bullet gun. So I really was tested.
Mm. I mean, have there been other times, like when you were younger, obviously your grandfather's legacy is incredibly important. It's incredibly influential to you and so many other people. You know, before you got involved in this, like, what was the development of your politics and how you view the world? Like, how much of that has to do with your grandfather's legacy? How much of that has to do with you educating yourself? Like, when did that start happening, and how did that start happening?
So in the beginning, I knew pretty much the basics as anyone else. As responsible for what I knew as the public school system would teach you about Black history. And parts of it I was ignorant about, like the Underground Railroad, you know, on national television asking, where is the driver, you know? just
absolutely. And tell the youth about things like this so they know and they can appreciate what we have now. Well, there has to be an opening for the railroad at some point. Because somebody's driving the train. It's not electric like what we have now.
It wasn't a train, baby.
I didn't want to bring it up. I wasn't
sure.
No, it's fine.
Listen, I'm grown now. That was not cool. And then the fact that I'm the type of person, when I think that I know something or I've touched something, I won't stop. So I could have at least shut up. But I didn't. So there we had that infamous moment. My God. But, you know, I have a wealth of knowledge from my grandfather. And when we would go over his house on Sundays, I remember we used to sit there. He had on his boxers and a t-shirt and a can of Coca-Cola. And he would point to every single picture in his room and tell us about every single person that he knew. And so I knew a lot. I think that moment, of course, being on national television was like, this girl knows nothing. But I do actually have some background. However, when it comes to politics and the way that I feel I'm able to represent myself now in these different forums, that's just straight being up all night long, not sleeping, learning online, getting Biden in office and Kamala, and I mean, all the way down to our Senate here for Georgia. Mm-hmm. I literally was like in school. So we were in the pandemic. I wasn't filming Housewives. So I would finish filming Dish. I would literally start studying from that time on, be with Pilar from about maybe like 5 to 9 o'clock, put her to bed. And I'd go in my room, my laptop, and lots of notebooks, and constantly write down keywords that I needed to learn more. I watched a lot of interviews. And of course, you know, from the way she speaks, you'll know, Angela Davis. I mean, so many of her interviews, and I would go look up anything that I didn't understand that she was talking about. She always talked about an abolitionist imagination and all these different things, the things that I felt, but I did not have the words to put to it and to be able to articulate. But I just really wanted to make sure that if I ever were to be interviewed, I would be able to speak intelligently about it and be able to be heard. And, you know, again, it's all about being effective.
Well, it makes sense. You are in the Atlanta area, so you are a one woman HBCU.
Okay, right. Look, I had to. You know, people don't think about the fact that when you're on reality TV, you have this big responsibility. They don't care that I didn't go to a HBCU. They don't care that I didn't go to a college. It's not like I'm going to start every interview saying that. So no, you still have to be a grown ass woman and go inform yourself about things that you don't learn. Because again, I have this responsibility when I open my mouth about such a deadly topic like this that concerns us Black people.
How can people support Breonna Taylor's case and her family at this point?
They're looking to impeach Daniel Cameron.
Ooh.
Yes.
Now, okay, before we get too far, I think you need to, because you have done a lot of work around this, explain to people who maybe haven't heard of Daniel Cameron who he is and what he symbolizes to the Black community.
He symbolizes what Trump was to America. Okay, just an embarrassment at this point, strictly off of his politics and how he is handling things. So Daniel Cameron is the attorney general in Kentucky, and he has the power to have fired these cops, to get them indicted, and he has done nothing, okay? Literally nothing. Mm-hmm. And we all know we've been counting down the days since Breonna Taylor died. And, you know, you see nothing is done. It's all his fault. Okay. It's his fault. So to me, I feel like what's happening now with the grand jury wanting to impeach him, I think that is the right thing to do. This should have happened a long time ago. You know, the case when it was given to him, I think when they saw that he was mishandling it or being partial, he should have been kicked off of it immediately. But that didn't happen. So now, yes, I think that he needs to be gone.
So if he loves Trump so much, he should be impeached like Trump. Is that what you're saying?
I think they should have matching impeaches. Yes. He should have been at that rally, okay? Mm. I can't believe that Trump actually had my way playing when he left. Like, it's your way. That's the reason why you're getting out of here. Like, he's so arrogant. He doesn't even get it.
I think it's also important to reference that Daniel Cameron is a Black man.
Oh, yeah, I forgot that part.
Yeah, I just want to make sure. And so the fact that he's being so awful around Breonna Taylor's case and indicting an officer for shooting into the apartment next to her and not indicting anybody for shooting into her apartment, which killed her.
Okay, but this is also a man who had an engagement party at his house like nothing had happened. And meanwhile, his city is upside down. This is like in the middle of when everybody in Kentucky was protesting and he's having an engagement party. Like, oh, nothing. Regular day.
Is there a way that we can put pressure on or we can figure out how to put pressure on them to impeach him?
Yes, I think that you continue, number one, simplest, make sure you continue to say Breonna Taylor's name. Make sure you continue to post about her case. As many people as you think know about it, it's probably that many people who don't know about it. If we all are aware of her case, then we can all stand together collectively. I think we should still be making phone calls. We still should be sending emails. Get your girl. Everyone has a friend who can send a nice email. Okay, nice, nasty email. That is who I have a cousin who did a couple of them for me. But yeah, you just constantly have to just make sure that your voice is heard. Email. Also, make sure you log on to untilfreedom.com. Go on their website and they have a lot of information, a lot of new things that they're doing. Also, Tamika Palmer, Breonna Taylor's mother, on Instagram, she also posts a lot of different rallies that you can support. And you say, okay, well, what's a rally? It's still show that we're making noise, that a lot of people are really involved and want to see justice for her daughter. So it's very important to still show up in numbers to every single thing that she posts.
Have you gotten to the point that I think a lot of activists get to because you've been working on something so hard, you've been focused so much on a case that when people talk to you about anything, you somehow get it back to the thing you really want to talk about, which is, you know, this case and changing what's happening in Kentucky and the Breonna Taylor case? Like, are people like,
yeah,
well, tell us that fight from about the fight from last season. We should be fighting for Breonna.
Right. There you go. Okay. Now you're talking like my aunt, Elizabeth Omalami. So my grandfather's daughter is Elizabeth Omalami, and she runs my grandfather's charity, our family's foundation. And that's the first thing she told me. She said, listen, I don't want you to take one phone call until you hear this. And she said, it does not matter what they ask you, because we know they want to know everything Portia. And she said, yes, it is about Portia, but Portia is now standing in the line for Breonna Taylor. Every time someone brings up something that you may not want to talk about, or see and they're veering off, she said, just take it right back to the case. So that's actually a tactic that she taught me that she has always done. Because, you know, when people interview you, they can just say, oh, I just want to interview you, and it's going to be about this. And they don't ask you about it one time. Well, I get it in there no matter what. Okay. We're going to say Breonna Taylor's name. That's what we're going to do. You're going to act interested today. Yes.
So this season on United, this past season on United Chase, the season we're working on now, we actually filmed an episode in Atlanta and specifically about black people, and we need to give black people more STEM skills and tech and education. Same thing you were talking about, how the Atlanta public schools do not educate black kids the same way they educate white kids.
Right.
But the thing I always like about Atlanta, there is a specific type of blackness in Atlanta that does not exist anywhere else in this country. Can you talk about one of the meccas of black folks at Atlanta?
Well, Atlanta is the mecca of black folks because we network like none other, okay? Like, I don't know if you saw after the inauguration, we had like an inauguration party, okay? And it was all about politics. I think when people first get here, they feel like, oh, it's a party place, party, party. No, it's a lot of movers and shakers that are here. That's a lot of people that move here to be a part of Black Mecca. We're dreamers. We don't feel like we should be stopped at all. I mean, look what we did. We turned our state blue. Mm. And that's from getting out there and banding together. We do what people think we cannot do. And so, yeah, our HBCUs are popping down here. Mm-hmm. And we do have a lot of civil rights leaders who grew up here, who lived here, Martin Luther King, you know, everybody, my grandfather. And, you know, so it's the Black Mecca. It really is all the way around. We've taken over all of Atlanta. I think maybe Duluth and Alpharetta is still not taken over yet, but we're going to migrate out that way.
Well, one thing I've learned from you, because I sort of feel like on social media, I try to keep it all on the same brand. There's things I won't put out there. Not even important things, but just silly things. I'm like, people take me too seriously to be silly. And now I've really learned from following you on Instagram. Like, oh, no, put it out there. Let's see what happens. So
Let me just speak to that from you, and I'm glad, and I actually appreciate you saying that you've gotten a little bit of that courage for me to do that, because guess what? Listen to this. I understood solely that God had picked me for just who I am, for the way that I speak, the way that I look, everything about me he wanted to use for his purpose. And when you are in your purpose, nothing else matters. You just need to be focused on your purpose and do what you're supposed to do. You are still human and you still have to live your life. So I never wanted people to put the activism or anything else on me, a journalist, whatever, and put me in a box. I have to still live my life. And guess what? Maybe that picture of me in that bikini may attract a young girl and say, oh, I love how she looks. And then the next post may educate her as well, or the next post may uplift her. So no, you can be well-rounded and used within your purpose. And that's all that really counts. You don't have to change not one bit. It actually would be refreshing for them to be like, oh, he's silly as hell. We got dry humor. Like, trust me, it's okay.
I didn't know you were going to minister. Is that next on your list of things to become? Because I feel like you just ministered to me.
Well, no. But, you know, everybody got a little minister in them. Everybody is a minister now.
I just want to thank you for coming on here today. I really appreciate it. It was such a pleasure to meet you when we met a few months ago. And we've interacted a few times on Instagram, but I just really wanted to share your voice, because a lot of people went through 2020 in the way you did, not the same way, but they really had to start educating themselves. But not everybody lets people know they had to educate themselves. A lot of people like to act like they were always smart, or always educated, you know. And I'm not, you know what I'm saying? I always knew this, even though I just Googled it. But I appreciate you being so open and honest about it, because I think it's a lot of people can relate to this. I mean, I can relate to this. I do the same thing.
Yeah, it's just us being real and where we are now, and we have to elevate. That's what we've all had to do during this time, and that's what I encourage most of all, is because a lot of people, especially when it comes to racism, I don't know, I didn't know. Okay, go learn. Guess what? My black self is going to go learn some more too, so we all can know exactly what we need to know to really have some change. One of the things that you asked me about was how do I balance it all, and you didn't ask just now, but I just feel.
Let me do it. I'm gonna set you up.
Okay.
How is it that you're doing a bunch of full time jobs? Your activism is a full time job. Your entertainment career is a full time job. Being an entrepreneur is a full time job. Mom's a full time job. How do you put that all together? How do you balance it all?
I'm glad you asked. I don't. Okay, I just needed to say that. I just needed to say to people that you don't, okay? You don't necessarily. Who's to say? Who gonna tell me I have it balanced? Who gonna tell me? Somebody gonna say, oh, you look pretty balanced today. No, that's not how it works. We're all just trying to maintain and do the best we can do. And if there's one thing that I felt led to say on your show today, is to just continue to do what you're doing and really try to compartmentalize and be the best and prioritize your life in the way where you will be most effective. And you only can do that through prayer. You only can do that through trying to identify what your purpose is, constantly pray for that. And when you're aligned with it, everything will feel naturally. And what falls off will hurt, but you will be able to survive because you're doing the right thing, what's going to please your spirit. Because right now, okay, we all were born for a time like this. But yeah, I just really, you know, wanted to make sure that people don't think that all of this is just, oh, she's juggling this. Listen, I went to go work out this morning. My hair looks absolutely crazy. So I just popped this wig on. My mom just bought me this wig. So yeah, it's not together. I haven't been looking like this all day at all, okay? Look like a complete crackhead like Halle Berry in that movie, okay?
Jungle Fever,
yes.
I'm agreeing. I'm just giving you the reference for the movie. I'm not saying you look like Halle Berry in Jungle Fever.
Oh, yes, he did, y'all. He said, I look like a crackhead. Thanks. This is how you treat your guests? Great. Oh. But no, it's we're all human and doing the best we can. And listen, these days and time, the depression we just went through with Trump, listen, it's we can go nowhere but up from here. That's it. you guys are awesome.
Yeah, thank you for doing this. I really respect you and appreciate you and am inspired by you. Even today, more inspired, because I think minister is going to be the next slash on your business card, but we'll save that for a minute.
Well, I'll pray about that. How about that?
Okay.
I'll pray about that one.
Thank you so much, Portia.
Portia Williams is one of the stars of The Real Housewives of Atlanta and co-host of Dish Nation. She's also the entrepreneur behind Go Naked Hair and Pampered by Portia.
She has a memoir coming out later this year called The Pursuit of Portia.
And if you want to keep up on the latest in Breonna Taylor's case and be part of actions to demand justice and support her family, visit untilfreedom.com. That's untilfreedom.com.
And as Portia mentioned, you can also follow Breonna's mom, Tamika Palmer, on Instagram at Tamika Palmer. That's TamikaPalmer.
Portia is a quality follow on Instagram as well. You get to see a lot of her life. You can follow her on Instagram at Portia For Real. That's at PORSHA4REAL. That's it for this week. Thanks to Renika Moore of the ACLU and Portia Williams. And also thanks to Lauren Wilson, who helped out with tech support at Portia's house.
You can tell us when we were wrong, maybe even when we were right, by leaving us a voicemail.
We want to hear from you at 917-477-6525.
That's 917-477-6525.
Nobody beats the Wiz. And keep your comments and questions coming on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and other places with the hashtag Politically Reactive.
And rate and review the show wherever you get your podcasts. It does spread the word and help people discover the show.
And as far as promotion goes this week, I just want to promote untilfreedom.com and aclu.org. You can go to those places. It only takes a second to do a couple things that will make the world a slightly better place.
And just a reminder, we both have Netflix specials available. You can hear me on the Kundabola Brothers podcast as well. And I was on the BBC News Quiz, so you can download that podcast as well.
Politically Reactive is a production of Topic Studios and Warner Media Podcast Network. Executive producers are Maria Zuckerman and Christy Gressman.
And me, Godhead, Hari Kundabolu.
And me, Goodhead, W.O. That's not right.
Keep it in, Matt! No, keep no. it in!
And me, W. Kamau Bell.
The show is produced by Matt Martin, Malachi Seeger-Sakir, and Kelly Rafferty. Will Stanton engineers and mixes the show.
And thanks, as always, to Brontez Purnell for providing music for the show. Thanks for listening to Politically Reactive. Hey, Hari.
Yeah.
Did you know that I have 387,000.3 Twitter followers?
Oh, we're playing this game again?
I just didn't know if you knew that. That's a lot. 387,000, right?
Yeah, you got a TV show, man.
This is a lot of Twitter followers. That's all I'm saying.
You've had two TV shows in the time I've had zero.
I mean, we can. I'm sure there's reasons for it. I'm just saying. It's a lot. We can parse our way through it, but it's just a lot.
We've been playing this game since since you got totally biased, and I had slightly more than you did. We tracked it on the way up. We tracked it when it was basically tied, and we tracked it as you quickly surpassed that number.
Yeah, maybe I'm just better at Twitter than you. Anyway, all right, let's keep it moving.